everyone. You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, listener-supported, open house, grassroots, community radio, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. And I'm Caroline Kilborn. My daughter and co-host, Monica Hadley, is not able to be here today. We have a most interesting guest today, someone I know you're going to want to hear what she has to say and hear about her book, which is Train to Nowhere. It was a documentary on PBS, and you may have heard of the situation, but this is an in-depth study of it, and really, really amazing. So, Colleen,
yeah.
Krantz is our author's name, and Colleen, where are you from?
I live in Adel now. I'm originally from Guthrie Center, in western Iowa.
So you're an Iowa girl.
Yes, I am.
All right, good. And tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, studied journalism at Iowa State and spent about a decade working at various metro newspapers before I decided to stay home with my kids. And as I was starting my life as a stay-at-home mom, I decided I wanted to be doing something with my writing and started researching this story and really essentially took my time at it because I was dealing with late nights with newborns and so on.
Yes, I've been there, yeah. Okay.
Chipped away at it and gradually put together what was a book proposal. And eventually we had this spinoff into a documentary as well, but the book came about sort of indirectly after I almost gave up on it and worked on the documentary, but luckily we found a publisher, Ice Cube Press, and
Now, the publisher is an Iowa firm, correct?
Yes.
Ice Cube Press, I think, and they have done a lot of great things. They really have.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that they decided to work with us. Obviously, it was some of the publishers that had conversations with the literary agent I worked with were concerned that, as they put it, immigrant tragedy stories might not sell well. But I kept feeling, from my background as a journalist, I just felt like this story had those sort of elements that all come together to carry the story through, and that I was convinced people would find it interesting if I'd get the chance to tell it. And luckily, Steve with Ice Cube Press felt the same way. So.
Well, this was a story that needed to be told.
Yeah, we felt it was one that has maybe some different elements that you don't
right.
typically hear about when you discuss immigration or when immigration is covered in the media.
That's right. No, there's so much
different characters. Maybe
there's so much misinformation and hysteria, really, about it. I have a paper here.
Also, some assumptions when.
There's a lot of myths.
Yes, and, exactly.
And I have some of those here we might talk about later. So, or you might have to take on some of those too, because people are. Of course, it's. I don't know as they might have heard this story, Train to Nowhere, but they've heard a lot of different stories. And as you know from playing that game as a child, when you whisper to somebody and then they whisper to somebody and they whisper to somebody, it comes out entirely different.
Yes, exactly.
And that's what's happened here, I think.
Sometimes with, they might try to tell the story as much as they can and try to get all sides, but
mm-hmm.
The reality is sometimes they're not even talking to the undocumented immigrants because they're, the immigrants themselves don't have much incentive to put their name out in public. So sometimes it is hard to kind of get the whole story. Or, in our case, we included an immigration agent, and you don't often hear their stories either.
Right. Now, one thing that puzzled me for a while was why immigrants use false names. And then... because to me that was a fraud in the first place.
Yeah.
So if then they are arrested and so forth, they have that double whammy, so to speak. But I was told, well, it's because they buy social security numbers on the street so they can work.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And so I, of course, someone's making money off of them, of course. And and not only that, but I was amazed at the amount of money that this whole thing that the coyotes make in bringing these people across and into the United States, especially from Central America through Mexico, the billions of dollars a year.
Yes, exactly. and it's, you know, it really is a business, and I think that's, you know, I guess if there's, I tried to tell this story as, in as balanced a way as I could, but obviously if there's, if anyone looks at this and feels like there's a bad guy, most people would point at the, point to these smugglers, because they're making a living off of this desperation, and they're making, some of them are making very good money, too.
Oh, yes. And they definitely are, and they're called coyotes, and I can see why.
Yeah.
That's a good word for them, really. Okay, let's start. So you, how did you hear about this?
Well, first of all, just to explain the background, for some people might remember, but it was in 2002 when a grain elevator worker in Denison, Iowa, opened a rail car, a grain hopper,
mm-hmm.
as he was getting ready to load corn. This was in October, and found these 11 bodies. Eventually, they figured out that they were undocumented immigrants who had been placed inside this rail car by smugglers, and the smugglers had locked the top door of the rail car, because they knew if they left it unlocked, it was more likely to be checked by the Border Patrol agents who inspect trains as they come into southern Texas.
Okay.
So these people were already in there. And what happened is I was working at the Des Moines Register in eastern Iowa at the time, doing reporting on state news.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was in eastern Iowa and because others were covering this, I was not very much involved in the covering this when it happened, you know, at the time that the bodies were found. But it was a story that sort of stayed with me as I, you know, decided to stay home with my kids. And I kept thinking what, you know, imagining what it would have been like for those people to be locked inside this rail car and, this, you know, this horrible temperatures and this extreme humidity. And so as I started, you know, that's when I started researching it a little bit and found some of the people to be extremely interesting, and that's really sort of how it all started for me.
But I don't. It's interesting to me that you're able to get the backgrounds of some of these people. Of course, they had trouble identifying them too.
It took them, I think, 7 months to get. Well, they got DNA samples from the bodies. I mean, the bodies were badly decomposed enough because they'd been in the rail car for about 4 months before they were found.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had to take DNA samples, and, you know, the forensic scientist eventually had to, you know, using various methods, you know, phone calls from people who had been missing someone for 4 months and so on. They basically used these a combination of tactics to narrow down who these people could have been. And
mm-hmm.
then one of the, an FBI agent made several trips to Central America to obtain DNA samples from relatives of those who they thought might have been among the victims. So between travel and waiting for DNA sampling results, this took a long time to identify the bodies.
Was there some hesitancy on the part of relatives not wanting to get in trouble themselves, maybe?
Say that again, I'm sorry.
Was there some hesitancy on the part of the relatives not wanting to get in trouble themselves to identify that
there might have been a little bit of that at first, but eventually when you have, you know, in a lot of cases they maybe had one relative who was in the United States legally, so they
okay.
would rely on that person to contact authorities.
Yeah.
Or they maybe would, you know, have a friend who was legal, or have somebody call from, you know, Mexico or Guatemala. I think there was enough fear about what had happened to their relatives that was sort of secondary, but
mm-hmm.
they did try to consider, you know, who might be the right person to make this phone call for us.
Well, I noticed there were a lot of several pictures in the book and of the individuals, and I thought that was really, it really adds to the story a great deal.
Well, it's funny how difficult that was, too.
I'm
the
sure
government collected most of those, if not all of them, but you can tell that some of them are poorer quality just because in some cases they and especially people from Central America might have lived in a situation where there was a lot of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there were not a lot of photos taken at all, and so
right.
in some cases they just had the driver's license photos to rely on.
And we know how good those are.
Yeah, exactly.
We've all had experience with that. Okay, so this took You said about 7 months for this investigation, and how did you get in on it then?
Well, I actually did not start reporting on it until so the bodies were found in October of 2002, and I think about a year later they announced who the people in the rail car were. A few of them they were sort of known before that or suspected, but that would have been in 2003, and it wasn't until a couple years later that I sort of had the time to look into this more. So in around it was 2005 or late 2005 and 2006 that I started working on this, but really just took my time, as I said, and started, you know, using my my reporting skills to get documents and start from there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was able to identify people that I felt were people I wanted to interview or try to interview and go from there.
Did you have to travel to interview people, or?
Sometimes the interviews were the trickiest. We had a train conductor who had ended up doing some time in prison in this case because he was essentially selling the train schedules.
Yeah.
The smugglers. This made it possible for smugglers to have the undocumented immigrants waiting to jump on the train at the last minute and have less of a chance of being caught.
And also to know which cars might
be
empty.
I think we were lucky to get this interview because, as you can imagine, he didn't have a lot to gain, this train conductor, by talking to us. You know, he was essentially working with smugglers. And so it took some a number of phone calls of talking with him. And we were, really, I feel like he did this maybe as, even though he doesn't feel responsible for the deaths, he says, I think he did this as sort of a penance.
Oh, well, I can understand that.
Yeah.
Now the rail car, I did not know this, but when it's for corn, it's not just a whole rail car, open the whole way. It's slanted, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. It says there's in each grain hopper that you see where they load corn. There's sort of three compartments in each rail car, and. Obviously, toward the top, they're square, but they all slope at the bottom to allow the grain to be unloaded from the bottom easily.
Uh-huh.
Later, well, in this case, the grain hoppers were empty, except for the people, but those bottom doors were locked and you had to have a special wrench to unlock them from the outside, and the top door had been latched from the outside by the smugglers.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can imagine, you're essentially trapped in this steel oven. Up to 95 degrees, not counting that's on the outside, something in that range that day, and so it would have just been horrific inside there.
So you found out the whole journey. So the young man whose brother was in New York State?
Yes.
Okay, let's take his journey. Started in Guatemala.
Okay.
And he felt that he could have a better life in the United States, and since his brother had been here several years and I think was had a respectable job and everything, he felt that he maybe could go join him. Was that his motivation?
Yeah, exactly. And his name is Byron, and Byron and his big brother Eliseo are I focused on them heavily in the book because for a number of reasons, but it was going to be hard to tell everybody's story in that
of
detail and feel like you could get to know them. And Byron was interesting because he was the youngest of a family with nine children, and Eliseo was the oldest. Eliseo had come to the United States in the mid to late 1970s, also illegally, but eventually had become a legal resident and a citizen, and had really done well financially. He'd worked his way up and tried to, as he would say, always stay away from drugs and alcohol, and eventually became the owner of his own landscaping firm in New York State. You can imagine his youngest brother back in Guatemala, who they are trying to convince that all the other siblings have left by now, and he's the last one on this Guatemalan farm with mom and dad, and all his siblings are, you know, basically pleading with him to stay on the farm and help his parents.
I'm sure
they're aging and they need the help. But he feels sort of, you know, that this is a little unfair that everybody else has gone off to see the world, at least to other parts of Guatemala. And they're giving him money so that he does okay financially, and the family is doing better now because of the money being sent home from the United States by Eliseo. But this sort of nags at Byron that he hasn't had the chance to make his own money. It's sort of a sense of pride, but also maybe a sense of adventure that you would expect from an 18-year-old.
Well, yes.
Sort of paid this horrible price for it, though. You know, the sad part of the story, that he made a bad decision that is probably not uncommon for many teenagers. You know, the type of decision or type of circumstance is different, but, you know, he had this horrible consequence.
So there's quite a process that they go through, pass from one coyote to another, and it's not a inexpensive endeavor either, because
I talked to several others who did not, several women who made a similar journey, and in fact were with some of the people who died in the train for part of their trip from Central America, and they ended up on a different rail car or didn't actually end up getting on the train that they were supposed to, so they survived, but they said they spent probably $7,000 coming from Central America. And, you know, if you can imagine, they're essentially taking loans from relatives, often relatives who have come before them, and they're, you know, going to repay them by working here.
Mm-hmm. Well, it might take a long time to repay, too.
Yeah, I talked to one of those gals recently, and she said, you know, it's just something they chisel away at slowly, and because it comes from relatives, there's probably a little more understanding, but it's something you always have hanging over you, at least for a long time.
Well, okay, so he was set out on his own, and just getting through Mexico is not easy.
Yeah, so we don't know a lot about Byron's trip specifically through Mexico, except that these women probably were taking a similar trip, and these two women ended up in a, as they came into southern Mexico from Guatemala, they ended up in a semi-trailer, the back of a semi-trailer, with, I think they said, 50 other people, and there were uncured cattle hides in this trailer, and they're in extreme heat again, so they said the stench was just horrible.
Oh, I bet.
I think that it took them, I can't remember, it was a day and a half or so of traveling that way to reach Mexico City, where they changed transportation to buses. And at that point, we know Byron was in the same, I believe he was in the same hotel where these women ended up, and probably, like them, took buses to the U.S.-Mexico border.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, he sort of switched from Central America, Mexico smugglers to the smugglers that know the U.S. side. And I think many people probably don't realize that there's smugglers in Texas who help undocumented immigrants get past sort of interior checkpoints that are usually about an hour from the actual border. So as you come along a major highway, you'll come to these where your car will be checked or stopped. And so these U.S. smugglers would take them from the U.S.-Mexico border, and they keep them in stash houses in some of the border cities, such as Harlingen. And this is what happened to Byron and some of the other people. They were in this stash house or drop house where they would wait until they had a chance to get past those interior checkpoints.
Well, you wonder how they can get past those, don't you?
Say that again? I'm sorry.
You wonder how they can get past those checkpoints when they check vehicles pretty thoroughly, you know?
Well, and I think that there's enough volume of traffic that the inspectors realize they have to keep things moving somewhat, so they have to make these sort of quick decisions about whether this car should be checked thoroughly or just, you know, one or two quick questions and then wave through.
Okay, yeah.
That's tricky, but what happened in this case is they figured out that they might have a better chance of slipping onto trains in Harlingen, and the trains are also inspected, but you might, you know, maybe you'll get lucky and you can get somebody through on the train, and you'd be able to have a lot bigger group than if you were trying to move one or two in a car or truck.
And of course, the person who puts them on the train is not the person who opens the car later. That's somebody on up the on up the rail, on up the...
Yeah, and I think it can vary, but typically if they, you know, you might have the higher-ups who are in sort of in this loose organization, and they, those smugglers sort of are in charge of collecting the money, and they make arrangements. And then maybe you have some younger, often younger men who are probably undocumented immigrants as well, you know, trying to make a little money, and they might take jobs where they're, you know, working with these smugglers. They might ride along inside a rail car or on the outside, and you know, in this case, that was done, and they were supposed to release the or open the rail car top at a later point.
Mm-hmm.
But
it didn't happen.
Look, that didn't happen.
Yeah. Well, did I? Is it my understanding? I think I read this that there were two different rail cars in which there were illegal persons, and one car was stopped and searched, and they were taken off, but the other car was not searched. And is that what happened?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the Border Patrol did check the train, this train that had already entered the United States. They checked it again after it was in southern Texas.
Uh-huh.
Kind of just south of Kingsville area. And as they were checking the train, they ended up finding this one rail car full of people. So,
okay.
And they were using dogs. They're not really sure what happened because the other rail car was nearby, maybe even right next to it. And they believe that maybe that locked hatch door and the fact that the inspectors were distracted by this... the inspectors and the dogs probably were distracted by this large group of people that they'd already found.
Mm-hmm.
So if they looked in the other rail car, they did not look in the middle compartment.
Oh, okay, that's right. Because
they may not
even
looked at all. They may have, just walked by. And if the dog did not alert again because of being distracted by the first group, it would have kind of just gone unnoticed.
And of course, the people in the inside were told to be quiet.
We don't know for sure. There were no survivors, but
well, I imagine they were told if there's commotion, you should be quiet.
That, you know, at that point, because of what we know from the people who got out of the second rail car, we know that it was already very uncomfortable. It was just extremely humid and hot already, but but they were not in real bad shape yet. Probably maybe one person out of the other group was suffering some kind of dehydration. But generally, they were doing okay. So at that point, the discomfort was probably not extreme enough to overcome their desire to get past that checkpoint. And eventually, obviously, that would have changed. And and then you can imagine how the mood and the situation inside the rail car would have changed.
Oh my, I guess. Well, this whole organization of smugglers is quite widespread. Across the southern United States, because it isn't just Texas, it would also be Arizona, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think you would find along through the whole border region, there are these U.S. smugglers and, you know, Mexico side smugglers, not always necessarily organizing with each other, but they know each other, and they know if they get in trouble getting someone in or get stopped somehow, they know who they can hand off to. Who they could sell these people to, in a sense. And it sort of becomes just part of daily life down there.
Hmm. Yeah, that's what is, I guess it's hard for us to understand, that this is going on. We have a picture of immigrants crossing the Rio Grande, okay?
Yeah.
And that's our picture of illegals trying to get in the United States, but there's much more involvement than that. I mean,
I agree. In fact, it's almost there's this feeling almost that it's they try to stop them at the river, but it's almost like there's all these other strategies for points and places where they might try to stop the illegal entry into the country, and it's not just at the river where that happens.
So now Mexico itself, if they find an illegal person like from Central America, they will deport them immediately, won't they?
Yeah, I think it's we forget that Mexico faces the same sort of situation the United States faces, where people from their southern neighbors want to come north, and so you'll have a lot of Central Americans entering Mexico illegally, and you know, looking for jobs either in Mexico or trying to continue on to the United States. So, it's kind of ironic that you know that a lot of people in the United States feel like. Now that we have to worry about people from Mexico coming in, but they forget that this is a situation in Mexico as well.
Right, and that there are people from Central America, definitely. For instance, this young man was from Guatemala.
Yes.
And where were these two young women from that were interviewed?
They were from Honduras.
Okay.
And they knew some of the other victims. And they're nervous even now. Look, you know, talking for this book, that they, you know, these smugglers might find out they talked, and yeah.
Oh yeah.
I don't know if they're just worried that there could be some danger for them, so they asked that we, ultimately leave their last names out. But I mean, you can imagine, because they come from small towns, like small rural towns, often like our small towns here in the Midwest, and.
Mm-hmm.
And
everybody knows everybody.
Everybody knows them, and
yeah.
Know when they're back, and so it makes them made them a little nervous. But they, you know, they were very generous to share their story.
Indeed, because it's a frightening thing to be, you know, to open yourself up to that. Do you think that many people who are stopped from entering and sent back to their native countries? Do you think they try again?
I do, and I think that you would find that out from government agents as well. They, in fact, if somebody from Mexico is found in the United States illegally, and they're, you know, say you're in southern Texas, if it's someone who doesn't have any major criminal records or accusations facing them, because of the sheer volume, it's, you know, the Border Patrol agents might essentially just drive them across the border, drop them back off in Mexico, and you know, within an hour or two or a couple of days, they're making another attempt to come back into the United States.
Okay, well, this is you're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM. This is Writer's Voices, and we're talking with Colleen Krantz about her book Train to Nowhere. Now, this book is not in. We got an advance copy. So when does it go on the news? When does it go on in the bookstores?
It's actually going to be out in June, and is on Amazon already.
Okay.
For pre-order.
So uh-huh.
It's under Train to. There's a Train to Nowhere Inside an Immigrant Death Investigation. But yeah, we're officially having the book out in June.
So are you planning to? Going to do book tours. I mean, go to different places and do readings and sign copies and so forth.
Yep, I'm the publisher and I have been talking about that recently. We've got some things set up already. I'm starting out with some things here in this area and working our way around Iowa and the Midwest. We'll do that, and we also will do, I guess, one of these book blog tours where we sort of have, I guess you quote, stops at various blogs. In my case, it would be a mix of immigration blog sites and also, you know, book blogs that we, I'd have a mix of, we'll have a couple people doing reviews, and I might do a few guest postings, and all that will start in the first week of June.
Okay. So how did you happen to find Ice Cube Press? Because Ice Cube Press is located in north of Iowa City, isn't it?
Yeah, north in North Liberty.
Yeah.
It was because of as the documentary. I worked with a Quad Cities director, Paul Kakert. He has Storytellers International, and he did the documentary with me.
Mm-hmm.
As we were getting that completed and ready to release in the fall, which is when it aired on Iowa Public Television, then that's when Steve with Ice Cube Press became familiar with the documentary and asked if I still had the the book available, and of course I was interested in. So So it was ironic that, as I said before, I was, about to give up on the idea of the book happening and had turned to this documentary so that I wouldn't sort of waste the research. And,
right.
And it was, in the end, it was sort of the documentary that led back to the book happening.
The research must have been incredible because there's so much detail, and to find out about these people's backgrounds.
There's just so many steps. And just for an example, in one case, I requested some federal documents and ended up in probably a seven-month off-and-on wait/battle to get these documents that I thought should be considered public. And that happened. There were several federal agencies that I was trying to collect documents from, because everybody from Border Patrol to the FBI to Immigration and Customs Enforcement was involved, and so I had to go through numerous agencies, including some state and local agencies here in Iowa, and request this big range of documents. And some were very quick to respond, and others felt like that they shouldn't release these documents because one of the smugglers has never been found, they consider it an open case. So.
Oh, okay.
So it just took a lot of time and persistence sometimes to get the documents, and then from there, finding the people or getting the interviews done took a long time, especially when you got to, when you're dealing with trying to find somebody who is in the country illegally, or maybe a relative who still is.
Right.
Or who's in a remote part of Central America.
Because, as I said before, they're very wary of being known.
Yes, as you can imagine, they have they don't have a lot of incentive to talk. And in this case, sometimes if it was a friend or a relative who died, they, as in the case with these two women, they might have been gave it more consideration typically because they felt like this was. Such a tragic thing, and they wanted to maybe speak up in this case.
Is the process for coming here legally, I've heard that it's extremely long and arduous. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that is true, and there's the federal government has a site where they actually list, based on what different document you're trying to get, what kind of visa or permit, they have a list where it shows what the current wait is. And, that might vary from, for the less popular documents that are being sought, it might be 2 weeks, but up to maybe 7 years. So,
oh my.
So sometimes the, sometimes the waits can be longer or shorter depending on things like the economy in the United States or demand for workers and so on.
Right. Or in some people's case, how much education they have. What kind of job they would be able to hold, things like
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So, did you ever consider self-publishing?
I hadn't reached that point yet, only because I sort of started exploring this idea of the documentary, and I just didn't know enough about self-publishing at that point. I hadn't had the time to look into it as an option, but. But I do wonder if it's something I would have ultimately done if this opportunity with Ice Cube Press hadn't come along.
So you said that you sent them a book proposal. Is that the ordinary way that you go about it?
For nonfiction, it is, because I guess that's the general practice, where for fiction you might send the whole manuscript, but for nonfiction.
Okay.
I guess it's kind of standard, or at least acceptable, to send maybe two or three chapters, and the rest can be the proposal, like this is what the rest of it would look like.
Mm-hmm.
And that was nice for me, because I could get the proposal ready, but I didn't have necessarily time to invest in completing all the research unless I knew I was going to have something coming out of it.
Okay, right. How many publishers did you contact?
Yeah, I think we actually hadn't approached too many. It might have only been like eight or so, but
well, that's quite a few.
We hit this point where they sort of go in cycles. They might be on break. You could think of it around the holidays, and and also it's once you hit those first ones that you think are most likely to be interested. At least from my understanding with my literary agent, that you're you become a little less optimistic because you're not sure that those, if your first guess is that those who are seeking a certain type of book are not convinced that this is right for them, then it's, you start wondering if the next round's going to go the same way. We did have some other publishers who said they really liked the idea of the book, and they just they're just worried that, you know, this sort of immigrant tragedy wouldn't sell extremely well.
Mm-hmm. So you think a literary agent is the way to go, though?
I've had good luck working with the agent I'm working with, who's in the Twin Cities. Mm-hmm. I've heard stories of other people who did fine on their own also. So I guess I haven't really drawn any conclusions that one way or the other is definitely better.
Okay.
For me, I just didn't feel like I... it was partly that I didn't know if I'd have the time or the connections to make this happen without that help.
Well, you had enough difficulty getting all the documents you needed without having to do all the rest of it, too.
Yeah, exactly. It was that kept me busy enough, just pulling the story together with the research.
Do you write on computer or by hand?
I use computer. When I was at newspapers, that's what I became familiar with and how I edited, and so it's where I'm comfortable.
How many drafts did you have before the final one?
I don't know. So I might have lost track on that by now. I think I probably did two or three sort of bigger revisions, and after that it was sort of whittling. But
well, you know, there was so much information.
Probably your own hardest critic, and the whittling can go on forever. So, so it's it was kind of an ongoing process for me, and especially as we got closer to the end, and you know, you think about sending out into the world and every little thing here and there.
Did you ever do you ever get writer's block?
I don't think I had too much trouble with writer's block exactly. I struggle more with arranging, you know, what's the right way to tell the story in order and flow and so on. I kind of went with the I was used to writing under newspaper deadlines where you can't get too much writer's block or you're in trouble.
Oh, right. That's right, because you were
there. That served me well in that I felt like it's okay to just get it down on paper quickly and then, get through it in one draft. And even if you're not happy the first time, just keep going. And eventually then I took the time to go back and sort of improve on it.
Well, I could see, when I read this, a journalism background, but it's also a very readable. As I told you, I read it first when we first got it, and of course, we've been doing other. You know, I have been reading other books for this program, and so then I picked it up again last week and started again, and I saw things that I had missed the first time, of course, but it's very readable, and interesting, and that to me would be difficult to do to keep it. Interesting as you went along.
Yeah, it's hard to think of what each of your the different types of readers. I think different people want different things when they pick up a book, even if already know they'll like this kind of nonfiction. You still know that some will like a lot of history thrown in, others won't want any. And so it's kind of it felt like a tricky balance to try to guess what your average reader of this kind of nonfiction would be interested in hearing about.
Well, how would you like to read a little bit from your book, Train to Nowhere? Could you do that for us?
Yeah, I'll do that. And let me know if I run too long or need to quit for a minute. Let me get a drink here.
Okay, that's fine. Listening to KRUU FM.
I'm going to start out by reading from Chapter 1, and then if we have time, I'll read a little bit from Chapter 3.
Okay.
Hang on a second here. Freight car GVSR 518018 looked like just another link in another train waiting on the edge of town. The standard graffiti sprawled across its faded coat of blue did little to set the railway car apart. The name of an old freight car remanufacturer, Golden West Service, dominated the side with its nondescript white block letters. Even the air that drifted up in the warm October afternoon as B.J. Shaney opened a top hatch door hinted at nothing out of the ordinary. If anything, he caught only the dank, musty odor of spoiling field corn. From his vantage point atop the train, Janie could see a steady stream of tractors hauling overflowing wagons of corn and soybeans to the grain elevator just west of Denison, Iowa. Cars and trucks coming and going from Denison buzzed by on U.S. Highway 30, running parallel to the nearby train tracks. It was October 14th, 2002. The weather was perfect for wrapping up the harvest. Clear skies and temperatures in the 60s. Eager farmers had been in the field since morning. Shaney, then a 28-year-old assistant manager at the grain elevator, had to help load a 100-car train with corn and send it on its way before day's end. The train had arrived the night before. Shaney and others working at the Farm Service Co-op Archer Daniels Midland grain elevator had already split the train into four sections. Shaney had been striding along the train's top for the past half hour, hopping easily over each gap to reach the next rail car. He would open three hatch doors on the top of each grain hopper, a type of rail car loaded from the top and unloaded from the bottom. Shaney quickly settled into a rhythm, released the lock, lift the holding bar, flip open the lid, glance inside for dirt or old grain, release the lock, lift the bar, flip open the lid, glance inside. The job's monotonous repetition gave Shaney time to think. His mind would wander in recent days to his wife, Jill, who was nearing the end of a difficult pregnancy. She had gone into preterm labor several times, and doctors had used medicine to stop the contractions. They had hoped to get Jill to the 8-month mark, and that time was drawing near. She had an appointment today. The couple already had two boys, ages 2 and 4, and had found out, but weren't telling others yet, that this baby was a girl. As he moved along the row of cars, the biggest event Shaney anticipated from the day was news of whether the doctors thought this little girl would wait a bit longer. Release the lock, lift the bar, flip open the lid, glance inside. GVSR 518018 was the second or third car Shaney stepped onto as he began walking along the top of the third string of 25 cars. He opened the first hatch door, saw nothing, and moved to the middle one. In his rush to get the cars opened that afternoon, Shaney easily could have missed them. The grain hopper might have been filled with corn and sent away with the rest of the train. Its hidden cargo might have been released from the bottom of the rail car, along with the corn, somewhere down the line. Instead, something made Shaney pause when he opened the middle compartment to look inside. Rather than moving along the rail car to the final compartment, he interrupted his rhythmic work to bend over slightly. The brief look would have been enough in most cases, but something here didn't feel right. He peered down into the dim compartment again. Something had caught his eye. He leaned closer, squinting. Something was there in the darkness. The shape of whatever it was didn't seem right for the typical overlooked pile of field corn. It was too irregular. Any small, hard kernels of corn would have spread evenly across the bottom as the train moved. Even if the corn had been wet and moldy, it wouldn't have looked quite like this. Shaney concentrated on the darkness a dozen feet below. He saw an oval shape, or maybe several. The color was also wrong. Shaney blinked, straining to see more clearly, to sort out what was what. Slowly, his eyes adjusted to the darkness. The unfamiliar shapes began to take on a form, becoming something recognizable. This is a Halloween prank, he thought, suddenly straightening up to look around for someone watching, waiting to burst into laughter at a well-executed practical joke. He and others at the elevator were known to play pranks on one another. Surely one of his co-workers was nearby. But he was on the far end of a string of cars, well away from the office. No one was around. Again, Shaney leaned down, studying the sloped bottom of the metal container. He stared, struggling with disbelief about what he thought he saw. But he knew it with certainty now. It was a skull. No, two skulls. There were more, perhaps many more, in the dark mass at the bottom of the compartment. Shaney straightened and took a breath. Below him, bones and clothing seemed to be all that remained of a huddle of bodies. No flesh, just bones and clothes. Shaney stood, squinting in the sun, thinking of scenes from mobster movies. These bodies, he guessed, were dumped by some gun-toting gangsters from half a country away. As Shaney sat atop the rail car, it never crossed his mind that 11 people, with dreams for a better life and a few dollars in their pockets, would willingly climb inside the rail car. It never crossed his mind that 11 people had visions of living the American dream and saw this 140-degree rail car as their only ticket there, a rail car that had been locked from the outside. As the realization grew that these were human remains, not store-bought skeletons tied to a bad joke, Shaney slowly reached for the radio on his belt. He pressed the button. He chose his words carefully, knowing his voice would reach all of his coworkers. "Tom, I need you to come out here and look at something," Shaney said to another manager, his voice surprisingly steady, despite the fact that death hovered a dozen feet below his boots. "Can't right now. We're really busy." "I need to show you something," Shaney repeated more deliberately. "What do you need? I'm busy." Shaney paused. "You need to call the cops. I have bodies out here." Should I continue from there, Carolyn? Or?
Well, let's see. We've got about 10 minutes left. Let's finish this first chapter here.
Okay. Alonzo Martinez Jr.'s cell phone rang as he turned his Ford F-150 pickup truck into the basement parking garage of his Omaha apartment complex. It was a little after 6:20 p.m. on October 14th, 2002, which was Columbus Day. Alonzo was just getting home. Many of his coworkers at what was then the Immigration and Naturalization Service had taken advantage of the holiday granted them by the federal government. But Alonzo had spent the day at the office in West Omaha. As the head of the Investigations Division for the INS's Omaha District, which included the states of Nebraska and Iowa, Alonzo had plenty of work to keep him busy. It had only been recently, after more than 25 years in immigration enforcement, that Alonzo had been thinking about retirement. His career with U.S. Border Patrol and later the Immigration and Naturalization Service had been a good one. He particularly enjoyed those first 5 years with Border Patrol, spent in the desert around Yuma, Arizona. Alonzo had patrolled the desert in a four-wheel drive truck every day. He grew to love the challenge of tracking people through the sandy terrain. He loved the chase. Not the capture so much, but the art of finding footprints in the sand or other subtle clues that would lead him to those attempting to enter the United States illegally. As a kid growing up in Del Rio, Texas, Alonzo had seen Border Patrol agents often, but had never had a problem with them. Over time, Alonzo's career moved into the investigative side of immigration. The job changes, many over the years, always seemed to come with a move to another state. When Alonzo had accepted what he guessed would be his final assignment in Omaha 4 years earlier, his wife had decided to wait in their home state of Texas for him to retire. They had it planned. They'd spend time doting on the grandkids and enjoying some free time once they were together again. On that particular October night, Alonzo would have grabbed food at a nearby grocery store, as he did most days. Before he could get out of his truck, his cell phone rang. It was his boss, who got right to the point. "Know anything about bodies inside a rail car?" Alonzo did not. Nor did he know how these people, these bones found 70 miles away in a western Iowa town, would eventually affect his life. How this time, the bodies would take on identities, become more to him than just another group of undocumented immigrants who died trying to escape hard lives.
Yeah, see, this is what I mean. You personalize the story to make us more want to go to the next chapter.
Oh, thank you. I think probably they got tired of me calling. I think I'd have all the information, and you know, things like where did you go for supper that night, or where would you have gone, and that's the kind of thing I would have to call back on. And luckily, all the people I interviewed were, as far as the main characters, if you call them that, were very cooperative and understanding that, and patient with me. So.
Well, I can imagine this was not an easy task, not only because of the time it took to research and get the documents and everything, but also just the emotional part of it.
Yeah, it's a hard story, and it's, I think it's, you know, and really it's essentially a crime story. I mean, there was arrest and investigation, that's part of the story.
Oh, yeah.
But people tend to think of it as an immigration story first, even though it's you could probably categorize it as a crime story. And that makes it tricky, too, because people are sometimes reluctant to give to listen to another thing about immigration because they feel like either they already know how they feel, or they know enough about it, or they don't think they'll get a balanced message. And that can apply to people with either viewpoint, or any viewpoint, I guess, on immigration. So it was, you know, I tried to be as careful as I could to sort of give everyone a fair shake in telling the story, and to keep my my own feelings out of it as much as I could. And, you know, as a journalist, that's your practice,
right?
Anyway, so that felt
right.
More comfortable for me to handle it that way.
Well, that's why I detected journalism background when I read this, because you did that, but still you told everyone's story. And
you know, and what was interesting to me was that there nobody I have worked with, but there were times where I was even when I was searching for a literary agent to work with, I was told by and again, this is not the gal I work with did not say this, but I was told by some that, you know, you can't just tell a straight journalism story, you have to have an agenda. And that, you know, I could see where there's room for books with an agenda, but it felt wrong to me. As a journalist, I wanted to try to tell a balanced story, and I was essentially told by, you know, not just that person, but several, that I really think you need an agenda here if you want to sell this book. And that sort of seems to be, I mean, you see that happening more and more, where you tell a story and you tell it to try to achieve an outcome instead of just letting the story be told and let the readers or viewers decide.
Right. Well, I think I from my standpoint, you succeeded in keeping it. You did not have an agenda, I don't think. If you had one, it did not come through, because it's very straightforward. The facts are the facts. You did tell the stories of the people's story with emotion, but not to the point where you're trying to convince anybody of anything, I didn't think.
And I guess one thing we think about, you know, is I think no matter how you feel about immigration, as a human, you're going to feel sorry for what these people endured, whether you agreed with what they were doing or not.
Right.
That's another matter, and so I feel like that's sort of a universal feeling, that this is maybe not everybody, but most people would have compassion for what they endured at the very least.
Mm-hmm. Well, they certainly. I had no idea that how the configuration of a corn rail car was. I mean, I never thought about that. But of course, it would have to be. They couldn't just fill the whole box car with corn.
Yeah.
It would have
probably
to be.
Not knowledge that will help you ever again. But now you know, right?
Yeah, now I know. Well, I hope I never get caught in one, or you know, am in one. I know there's a lot of corn produced in Iowa, and you, of course, you're an Iowa girl. As I am myself, and you have relatives around Fairfield too, don't you?
Yeah, I have a brother-in-law who grew up in Lockridge area, and he still has family in the area.
Okay. Well, that's nearby. I grew up in Newton, actually, which is kind of the center of the state, and then went to the University of Iowa, and then I've lived in Pennsylvania and lived in California and so forth, and currently live in Mount Pleasant, See, I'm very fond of Iowa, and
I'm the same way. I also left for a while and to St. Louis and Milwaukee, and it's home, and I love Iowa, and it was sort of always our goal to work our way back here.
Isn't that great when you can see, you can in the fields, you can see, you can row the corn now. It's just starting to come up, and that it's a beautiful sight, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's my husband is works in agricultural business, so he's always pointing these things out to me too. But I also grew up on a farm, but we were in the cow calf business, so I always watch the. I'm always looking for the baby calves in the fields, and that's my sentimental
moment. Yeah. Well, my second husband and I raise sheep, and there's not too many sheep raised around here, but I always look to see, you know, that the new baby lambs are something else too, of course. Okay, so let's go back now. They can get your book now on online, correct?
Yep, it's on Amazon. And so if you go to Amazon and search under the books category, you can search for Train to Nowhere. You'll I think there are some other, maybe an album or some other things named that, so you might have to put in Inside an Immigrant Death Investigation, or by my last name, which is Krantz, K-R-A-N-T-Z.
Right. So will it also be available at Barnes & Noble and other places?
I think they might have it on their website also already. It should be in the bookstores around Iowa and around the Midwest. And if it's not in a local bookstore, feel free to let myself know. My email's on my website, which is ColleenBradfordKrantz.com, and or the publisher, which is Ice Cube Books, and he'd be happy, I'm sure, to get some in the local bookstore if that's an easier way to go.
Well, we do have a very fine bookstore here in Fairfield, and I'm sure that they'll go out of their way to get this for anybody that wants it.
I think they've already mentioned that one to me as a good place to be. So
yeah, right. Train to Nowhere is it's a very moving story. It's a story that really everybody should read. I highly recommend this to everybody, no matter what your feeling is about immigration and the things that are going on in our country. You really should read this because it's just an excellent book. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Well, thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Okay. If you're listening today, you need to stay tuned now for James Moore and Planet Erstwhile. He always has interesting things on there. And Train to Nowhere, Colleen Bradford Krantz. Most interesting book. And I'll leave you with this. Do your little bit of good where you are. It's those little bits of good put together that transform the world. Bye-bye now.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.